separated you all from your demons, but you've still got a choice. Do something, or do nothing. Do something, and we can make them pay for what they did to you. Do nothing, and all your demons will know is that hurt of that final moment. Is that really what you want? We've got to stop this happening again.
Welcome to Kinfolk Lore, a podcast where we explore fictional worlds and bring people together. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and we're cousins that love to talk about world building, sci-fi, and fantasy. We hope that over time, through our shared love of our favorite stories, we all become family on this podcast journey.
For our first season, we are discussing His Dark Materials, the HBO BBC television show. Today, we're going to go through the episode and talk about our reflections on this world. So if you haven't watched His Dark Materials Episode 6, The Demon Cages, please stop, watch it, and come back when you finish.
In addition, we will be discussing adult themes and topics on this podcast. So avoid being distracted by a full-on snowball fight while the kids sneak away and listen. Keep an eye on those little buggers. This is episode 6.
We start the episode in Bolvanger, where Lyra is being escorted to the cafeteria for a meal. The room is full of other children, including Roger.
He's back! Yay!
Roger is back.
Love that kid. Love him. He's so cute and adorable, and he looks like he's kept up nicely. He's okay.
Yeah, he's doing all right. Pan and Roger's demon, Cecilia, have a quick chat, and they decide that for now they're going to pretend they don't know each other. Pan notes when he gets back to Lyra that Roger is different, but he's not hurt, and she's just happy that they're alive.
Yeah, she thought the worst.
I mean, yeah. Given what happened in the last episode, I don't blame Lyra.
Yeah, for sure.
So the scary doctor, and whose name is Dr. Cooper, and a nurse come into the cafeteria, and they summon a young girl named Bridget. Bridget and her demon are taken into a room with a metal door. We don't actually get to see what's in the room. And when the door is closed, there's a rumbling sign behind it. The scene is like really, really chilling. It's focused on the nurse who is standing outside waiting. She just has this kind of blank, dead in the eyes stare. And we can just hear noises coming from the room. And then Dr. Cooper emerges without Bridget and basically tells the nurse to come with her, and they leave.
Snap out of it. A little snappity snap. Ugh.
Yeah. Scary. It was like a horror movie. It was like definitely a lot of tension in that scene. In the next scene, Lyra is taken to see another doctor whose name is Dr. Rendell, and she's being measured by a device that kind of looks like a dental x-ray machine.
They're not checking for overgrown wisdom teeth on this thing. It's not happening.
No, they're probably measuring dusk, but Lyra asks, what are you guys measuring? What are you looking for? Is it dust?
Nice little icebreaker.
Yeah, and he's basically like, how do you know about dust? Who told you about that? And Lyra handles this very smoothly. First she says it's from another girl told her about it, and then she says, I wash frequently so you won't find any dust on me.
Played off nicely. Very nice.
Very smooth.
Congratulations.
Good job, Lyra. Dr. Rendell tries to calm her down by saying that the institution is a philosophical one and that she won't be hurt. Lyra is not convinced, but before she can really respond, they're interrupted by a fire alarm. All the children have to get dressed and they go outside to be counted. During this roll call in the courtyard, Lyra tells Roger that the Egyptians are on their way, but that she and Roger will have to help by finding a way to escape with the other children. She then creates a diversion by throwing a snowball, starting a big snowball fight. After Roger's like, please don't do this. I've been attempting all this time to just stay under the radar. You're here for 5 seconds and already causing a problem. He has a really great line that says, "You never could listen." It's just,
yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah. This is feedback that Lyra gets, like, in every episode. Somebody's like, "You're just totally insubordinate. Like, you don't listen." And she's like, "Nah,
whatever.
This is how I live." So all the children join in this snowball fight, and in the mayhem, Roger and Lyra escape from the crowd, and they start to look around the facility. Roger tells her that there's an area the children aren't allowed to go into, and he believes that's where the exit probably is.
Yeah.
That is not where the exit is. What they find instead is a room with all of these caged demons. Roger and Lyra walk through the room and read the names of the children who the demon belonged to. And eventually they get to Billy's, and there's no demon in the cage. Which Roger notes right away, this means that Billy is dead.
And then Lyra's like, "I'm so sorry." And Roger hits her with the, "You knew? Like, you should have let off. You definitely," to quote my cousin here, "you definitely buried the lead. Like, you're like, oh yeah, the Egyptians are coming, this, that, and that. You knew that he was dead," and he's a little bit salty for a minute. Then he gathers himself, and then the rest continues.
Yeah, I mean, when they were talking during the roll call, he asked about Billy, and she kind of dodged the question. So the fact that he finds out minutes later that Billy is dead, and she kept that from him, not a great moment for her. But I also understand why she didn't tell him in that moment, because, like, if she told Roger during the roll call, she doesn't know how he's going to react. She hasn't seen him in so long, and that's really heavy news to give someone.
Plus, she's like, "Yo, we got to break out of here," and Roger's like, "Yo, this ain't Jordan College. Chill the fuck out. Like, I ain't going nowhere." So she's like, "If I tell him that Billy's dead, he ain't rolling with me. Let me just wait a minute. We'll find out a little bit more, and then I'll lay it on him."
Yeah,
it's a good look. It's a good look by her.
I mean, it is a friend. It doesn't. Probably isn't her finest moment, but in terms of strategy, I think she made the right call not telling him when he asked.
100%.
Not in front of a big group of people like that.
100%. Yep.
So Roger draws the immediate conclusion that these other cages are full of demons, which means that the children that were associated with them must have still be alive. So he asks, if the demons are alive, then where are the children? So they do find the children in another room. It's a really awful scene, actually. There's maybe a couple dozen kids in this room. Some of them are laying down, some of them are sitting up, but they're all kind of just staring into the distance with dead eyes, and they're counting. As the fire alarm's still going off. And what really struck me about this particular scene and these kids was they were not evacuated. The other kids who still have some value to these doctors, the ones who still have their demons attached, they were evacuated. The ones they still need to perform this experiment on are still there. But the kids who have been severed from their demons are just kind of left there lingering.
And it's a good call by the people who are organizing this experiment, right? Because let's say you wheel out all the kids with no demons with the kids who still have demons. Now the kids who have demons are like, oh shit, they're going to cut away my demon. Because none of them really know what the hell happens to these kids when they disappear. So, like, let's keep these kids under wraps. It's shitty. It's not exactly, I mean, obviously, like, it's terrible. I mean, these people are monsters, like, horrible, horrible people. But I understand why they would keep them not from evacuating, because, man, if the rest of these kids find out and see it, it's going to be mortifying for them.
I know, but it's a pretty tough look, just because when they're... Okay, so this is a real fire.
Yeah.
Then they would have just let those kids die.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, we already have established that these are some of the worst people ever. Like, I can't even believe. I mean, just for what they're doing. Look what they did to Billy. Look what they're doing to all these other kids. And they wouldn't even let poor fucking Bridget wanted to eat. I just want my dinner. I haven't eaten my dinner yet. And then she just takes her. What a shitty. I'm sorry. I got really broke up by the dinner scene.
Yeah. I mean, that whole scene is really difficult because the other kids are just staring at her. Everyone is clearly terrified of having their name called. But in a way, they're all grateful it wasn't their name and it's this other girl. And it's like everything that Roger says in the scene is why they're so scared. The kids who disappear, like Billy, like Bridget, they just don't come back. They never see them again. So they don't know what happens to them.
Yeah. Hence hiding them away. Like they're already nervous. Seeing what happens to them would have been, I mean, it's chilling. All of this is chilling. I mean, the best thing that happens so far in this segment of the episode is you know, the reunion. I mean, what a friendship. The minute that these two lock eyes, you remember you're taking back to episode one and seeing them run through Jordan College and how happy they are. And I really think they nailed it, starting to open the door on like how the demons can be part of their soul by letting Cecilia and letting Pan be the ones who are communicating and not needing for it to be Lyra and Roger to be the ones talking.
Yeah, I love that. That was, you know, we were critical last week of how the demon stuff has been portrayed on the screen. That was, to me, them making some inroads into, like, Lyra doesn't have to talk to Roger if Pan can speak to Cecilia.
Cecilia.
Yeah, if Pan can connect with Roger's demon, Lyra doesn't need to be part of that conversation, which is just, it just demonstrates that Pan and Lyra are one.
Yep.
So 100%. That part was really good.
And then I really loved, I mean, even though it was like, you know, here's Roger. He's not here for these games. He's like, don't fuck around. You know, those who get caught breaking the rules, he says, they don't last long here. And, you know, here's Lyra. She's like, okay, don't break the rules. Hold on, Roger. Hold my beer. Let me go ahead and just throw this snowball real quick. Because the only way we're getting out of here is if we break the fucking rules. Let's roll. Like, you know, like right away, they're right back. And it was like, even though it was a little bit scarier, it was cool to see them start the snowball fight, then break away, go on a mission again. Because it was like the two of them were back together, like back doing what they do, you know? So that was that was good for me.
Yeah, no, it was a nice reunion. I'm so happy to see Roger again. He's so cute.
Yeah. Lizzie Brooks. She's out here asking all them damn questions about dust, about everything, keeping the doctors on edge. But, you know, she's got a plan. She knows Egyptians are coming. And we move on to the next portion where Lyra and Roger find their way back to where the children are and they blend in. Lyra tells Roger that they have an escape, that she has an escape plan, and that they need to help prepare the other kids. The next time the fire alarm goes off, everyone must be ready to leave because it's going to be her. We then see Kaiza flying towards Bolvanger. Could the Egyptians be close? We don't know, but, you know, he's definitely flying around over there. Dr. Cooper and Dr. Rendell share a drink in their office. They're getting chummy. They toast to the conclusion of their work, and she tells them that Mrs. Coulter is on her way. Dr. Cooper tells Dr. Rendell that ever since Billy broke out, Mrs. Coulter has been eager to return to the station. Dr. Rendell seems skeptical about the ethical implications of the work that they're doing. This guy has a conscience. And then Dr. Cooper says that they're doing what is necessary to free generations from the tyranny of sin. And if they get it right, they can prove to the magisterium the value of their work.
The tyranny of sin thing sent, like, shivers up my spine. Like, I was like, oh, wow, fanaticism at last.
yeah, she's, 110%. And it's good because they're not dancing around it. They have, you know, the magisterium is, you know, very clearly this religious order that has, like, basically put their mark on everything. So she's, in some ways, you feel like she's been totally indoctrinated. And in another part of me felt like she wants to do something to make sure that she's going to be free from the tyranny that is the magisterium.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so it's wild. You see all of them are being kind of like kind of burdened by this. That night, Lyra tries to sleep, but the sounds of other crying children leave her wakeful. Meanwhile, in our world, good old Jimmy Brooks, Will is in the heezy. Here he is looking at videos of his dad, Papa Brooks. No, John Perry, talking about the expedition to a reporter. In the video, John Perry says that this work has been easier to explain to Will than to his wife, Elaine. Side eye to my boy, John Perry, for freaking throwing his wife under the bus on national TV. Then, outside, both of Boreal's minions are watching the house. Thomas wonders why they aren't going in, and the other dude says they're going in soon enough. He's basically like, rookie moves, Thomas. Stick on the shit that you know, white-collar stuff. All right? Leave the creepy sit outside of the house while I watch a woman and her child to me. I've got this. My girl, Culty, a.k.a. Mrs. Coulter, arrives back at the station fresh off of bribing the most powerful forces in the South and the North. Hey, Elite Theometer, play Shook Ones by Mobb Deep. Because Lyra and Rose and the rest of the girls are shook, scared to death and scared to look. Because Culty is and her golden monkey are coming. Anne starts barking orders and tells all of the kids that they gotta be on point because the next kid that they take is gonna be from the boys' dorm. I resent that a little bit, but I understand. I respect it.
Okay. Annie, though, is our queen in this moment. Annie's like, listen, you do this, you do that. We gotta stay beneath the radar. I was like, okay. All right, Annie. I wasn't sure how Annie and Lyra were gonna get on. I was really impressed.
Yo, Annie was the boss in this moment. And even Lyra had to recognize, right? So I was impressed too. I was totally impressed. Mrs. Coulter is walking and demanding answers from the doctors about the recent mishaps. Both the doctors tell her about the advancements with their new equipment. Not only is the survival rate higher, but the children, they can be awake during and after treatment. Mrs. Coulter asks if the children are responsive after this procedure that they're calling a treatment. They say yes, but that they're unsure of how long that will last, and they promise her a demonstration. Now back in the dorm room, Lyra is stuck off the realness of her mom and showing up, blowing up her spot momentarily about her escape plan. Okay? She's like, no, this is going to all go bad. She tells the other girls that she needs help to hide. Annie figures out that she must know Mrs. Coulter. And when Lyra implores her to do what would probably be unthinkable to these girls because they're so scared, is to trust her. Bars from my girl, Annie. She takes the opposite approach of Lyra's conversation with Father Corum and says, I don't trust anyone in here. Not one. Lyra drops the big one here and admits that she is her daughter. She is the daughter of Mrs. Coulter. The other girls are shocked when Lyra tells them this and she knows that what she's doing is evil. She implores them and tells them that, you know, basically she's cutting away their demons. Annie looks shocked and bravely replies to Lyra. Okay, hide under the bed. Pull up when I tell you and I give you the cue, and we're going to hide you. Lyra hides under the bed. Her pull-up game is crazy. When Mrs. Coulter walks in to inspect the room, the golden monkey is sneaking around. Lyra pulls up on the bed, and she is, you know, searching around, and these kids are super duper smart. She asks, how come there's a girl that's not here? They basically say, oh, the girl that just got taken away, Bridget. And so Mrs. Coulter lets her go. Kinda, because the golden monkey's snooping around. And then in the next scene, she leaves, comes back in, little peekaboo action. She's like, out, comes back. And in the next scene, the Egyptians are making their way to Bolvanger through dangerous, icy terrain. Lee has finally got his lazy ass out of the balloon and is walking and helping. This is good. I'm happy.
Yeah, I mean, we'll come back to this later, but I loved Annie and these other girls. They are so bright and skeptical. Like, these children have been changed by what they have experienced. We see this from Roger as well. Roger is not the, like, sweet follower that he was when we saw him at Jordan College. Roger, in this episode, takes a leadership role, in part because Lyra tells him to, but also he carries out what Lyra's directions very well. And Annie is telling the other girls basically how to stay alive. And then she has to make this estimation about whether or not she can trust Lyra And she decides to go with, like, for now, I'm going to protect her. But she's very clear. Like, I don't trust you. I don't trust anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, these girls were on point. Annie, to me, was a G. Like, she was like you said, she was telling everybody where to go, telling them what to do, made the call to protect Lyra, like, came up with the reason why somebody wasn't in the bed when she thought, when it was about to all fall apart. Because, and let's be honest, we all know, Mrs. Coulter, let's go back to like, how good Annie has to be. Because Mrs. Coulter grabbed Lyra by the hair in the bathtub and said, don't lie to me. She says, I wasn't. He said, yes, you were. So she has a pretty good gauge of when people are lying to her. Like, she can pick it up really quickly. So Annie's got to be on the top of her game to be able to pull that off. And I was impressed. I was totally impressed.
Yeah, I was too. The kids in this episode are great. And the acting from the children in this episode is phenomenal.
Unbelievable.
Let's just talk briefly about what happened, what was going on with Will. So,
I don't know. I don't even know why we have this scene. Yeah,
this scene
Will last
was
week.
Really out of place to me.
Yeah.
I just don't understand. I mean, I watched the scene multiple times because I thought maybe there were some clues in the scene, but it just seemed like they were like, let's check in on Will. I didn't need this scene. We didn't need to travel into a new world in this episode because there's so much happening in Lyra's world. So
agreed.
I guess we're supposed to take from this scene that Boreal's minions are advancing. Like, at some point they're gonna go into that house to do what? I'm not sure, but I don't know. I just thought this scene felt really out of place. And it was super short. It does tell us one thing, which is that Will hasn't just gone back to his, like, day to day. You know, like, his mother telling him what she knew about his father, and also that his father left the letters. Obviously, Will did what most kids would do, which is, let's do a Google search and see what's out there on my dad. But, like, it really messed with the rhythm of this whole sequence. So I wasn't a big fan. And if we're going to visit our world, I need my boy Boreal to be, like, I never need to see his minions again.
Yeah, you got to see your guy Boreal.
Yeah, I need Boreal. Like, I don't want to see these other guys.
Thomas, why are you in the car? Like, what is Thomas doing in there? Like, he's better suited inside of a command center with computers and, like, ways to look up bank records. This is crazy. This is out of his line of work. He's not that guy. You
right.
Know?
Like, he should be, like, on the dark web, like, looking. Like, what are you doing?
Like, can he tap into the surveillance cameras or something? Like, he's not this guy. Like, it's so wild. I don't know. I think the other thing you're supposed to take from this scene, if anything, because I searched through, like, Jesse, why are we doing this other than we just want to remind everybody that Will's out here, is that they have a relationship. That Will, that John Perry was telling his son about the expedition, that it wasn't like Will, which is a little bit of an update, but they make it like Will was not so young that he couldn't remember who his dad is. It's just that his dad disappeared and didn't come back. But he has memories of his dad. So
okay.
I guess that's another thing.
But, like, let's talk about this. How old do you think Will is?
I don't know. Looking like, you know, like he's going to Degrassi High. He's kind of, I don't know. Will is kind of like, I don't know. He's like 12. He's got to be 12.
No, he's okay. So he can't be 12. So this is the thing that I thought. Something just doesn't feel right. Like, I think Will is supposed to be about 15. 14 or 15. Well, yeah. If he's 14 or 15, his father's been gone for 13 years. Isn't that what his mother told Boreal?
Yeah, that's true. So then he would have had to been
one or two.
So even more shade from John Perry saying, my one-year-old son understands what I'm saying about my expedition more than Elaine. Wow, that's not a good look.
Yeah,
I didn't
love this part. But anyway, I have more to say about our world in this at the end of the episode.
All right, let's move on to the next scene then.
Okay.
There.
So in the next scene, Lyra is in the cafeteria again. They're having another meal, and she's starting to tell the other children about her escape plan. And Lyra is fully embracing Lindsay Lohan's character from Mean Girls here. Annie was Regina George, head of the pack. And Lyra has now effectively taken over that leadership role. I loved it.
Yeah.
Just as she's like getting going, Dr. Cooper comes in and she tells Lyra to come with her. Yeah. So Lyra goes with her, but then she tries to make a run for it as they start to get closer to the room with the metal doors. Dr. Cooper tells Dr. Rendell to grab her demon, and so he grabs Pan, and Lyra is like immediately incapacitated. Like, as soon as he has hold of Pan, Lyra is powerless at that point. The next part is basically like just struggling. Like, Lyra is not going down without a fight. Pan is not letting her. Like, Pan is like, yeah, we can't let this happen.
He's like, do something, Lyra.
Yeah,
do something. Like, he's like, what are you doing?
Pan is really like a motivational, like a trainer in this, because he's just like, this is, don't let it happen, Lyra. And so
as he turns into a puppy, a rather cute puppy, once again fucking up the change, he's like, let me turn into this cute puppy, do something, Lyra, let's go. What, turn into a rhino, a fucking anything, something big enough to wreck this shit. What are you doing? Anyway.
Okay, but at least he was providing the motivation, no speech, right?
A cheerleader. I need my demon to wreck some shit. Like, I need him to, like, do something. I don't need a fucking cheering squad. I got that covered.
Okay, so this is actually a really emotional scene.
It is.
But
it is.
I mean, all jokes aside, the next 5 minutes of this episode just like wrecked me. So Lyra is fighting for her life. Like, as soon as she realizes that she's about to be separated from Pan, she just like loses it. And Dr. Rendell, in trying to calm her, said this thing that I was just like, I was like, wow, the way he put that is really upsetting. He says the procedure won't hurt. It just feels like a loss.
Oh.
Which the gravity of that, I was just like, wow. Like, that's such a way to put it. It really shows, like, how significant the demon, having your demon removed from you would be. So as they're preparing to close the doors, Lyra is screaming. And finally, she's just like, I have to use whatever I have in my arsenal. And she says, I'm Mrs. Coulter's daughter. And Dr. Rendell kind of pauses because he's like, okay, she knows Mrs. Coulter's name. Maybe we should listen to her. The other doctor, Dr. Cooper, is like, let's full speed ahead. But Lyra just keeps screaming. And then when Mrs. Coulter comes in the room, she screams for her. Mother, like she says, you know, that this is, I'm her daughter. And she's basically screaming to her mother to save her. Mrs. Coulter does actually stop the procedure, and they have this moment where they both see each other through the glass. Mrs. Coulter is like in this control room, and Lyra is in the room with the device that severs the demon, and they can't touch each other, but Mrs. Coulter reaches out to her through the glass. Great acting.
Great.
Great acting by Ruth Wilson. Like, she just, in that particular moment in this episode, I actually felt really bad for Mrs. Coulter. You can see how much she loves Lyra. In the next scene, her and Lyra are back in Mrs. Coulter's room, and she's trying to calm her down. She gives her a drink with an infusion of chamomile, and she tells Lyra that when she was a child and she used to get upset, this is what her mother would give her. She says, it was a surprise to me what you said in there. Who told you what I was to you? And she tells Lyra, if you have any questions, I will answer them. And she sort of just guesses what the first question would be. Why did you abandon me? And Mrs. Coulter says some pretty difficult things to her. So she basically says, well, Asriel had some ideas and I let him pursue his ideas. And I just wasn't equipped at that time to be your mother. I never meant to harm you. And this really upsets Lyra because she's like, what? I'm sorry, what? You never meant to harm me? I just came out of a room where somebody was going to take my demon from me.
My demon away. Yeah.
And she, the way Lyra describes it is also just like another tell of how important Pan is to her. She says they were going to cut Pan away from me, cut him out of me. And Mrs. Coulter says to her, well, this is about dust. And, you know, we're trying to do this research because dust is not a good thing. It's too late for the adults because they're deeply infected and they're condemned to a life of sin, guilt, and regret. But before puberty, if you can cut a demon away, you can prevent people from having troublesome thoughts is how she put it. The troublesome thoughts that demons bring after puberty. This was the best explanation of dust that I have heard so far in the show.
Yeah.
Like she's sort of explaining what it means, like why dust is important for the first time. We're 6 episodes in and she's just telling us now why this stuff, dust, is important and what role it plays. Lyra is not having this explanation. She's basically like, if this procedure was good, you would have let them perform it on me.
Okay, let's go back in the other room. She's like, I'm like, Lyra, what the fuck? She's like, oh yeah, it's cool. If it was good, you would have let them do it to me. Why don't you let them do it to me then? Why did you stop them? And Culty didn't have a good answer.
No.
She did not have a good answer.
She really didn't. And she said basically that even though the procedure is good and the research that they're doing is good, that the equipment that they're using is not up to standard yet. And that I don't remember how exactly she put it, but she basically said, it's not good for you.
Yeah. So basically what she said was like, you know, there's always some sort of collateral damage whenever you're doing an experiment. And so like, until we've worked out those problems with the equipment and everything else, that this equipment is not good enough to be used on you because I'll never let anything happen to you because you're my daughter. Like, but everybody else can suffer. To which Lyra's like, a little irritated. She's like, wait a minute. What about my friend Roger? What about Billy Costa? And she's like, well, no one's going to hurt them because they're your friends. And she's like, Billy Costa is dead. And Mrs. Coulter with the chilling shit, that ice cold shit, the shit that she's got running through her veins. She's like, oh, well, that's unfortunate. I'm sorry. You know, like basically those people will be fired that did it. And she's like very calm and matter of fact about it. Like, I'm sorry, but this is just, if you don't like what I'm doing, this is who I am basically. And you just have to deal with it because I have to do this. I was not, this was a tough one.
Yeah. I mean, this was very similar to what Dr. Cooper said when she was talking to Dr. Rendell about the tyranny of sin. I was like, okay, this is not just about Mrs. Coulter's ambition and her wanting to have a standing in this world. This woman is a fanatic. She's willing to sacrifice anyone. She's willing to put these children who she's tried to bond with through anything to get what she wants out of them. And through that, so like some of it, this felt very much like she was trying to correct her own actions and troublesome thoughts or whatever. Like this to me felt very much about her self-hate as well.
Yeah, I agree. I agree about her self-hate. And I think like it comes down to one thing that it kept ringing out to me was she felt so shamed and so condemned, like what Ma Costa was saying. After what happened with her husband and Azriel and all these things, she was feeling all those feelings, and essentially like this was her way in her mind of redeeming herself because she had all these thoughts and these feelings about what was going on, and so instantly the Magisterium has convinced her even that, oh, that's because of your sin, that's because of what you've thought about, that's because of all these thoughts you had going in your mind. No, that's not what it is. She just wanted to fuck Azriel. That's what it came down to. It is what it is. Okay, like that's it. This dust is making people want to do some shit, and that's what it is. And you just have to deal with it. I'm sorry. I'm amped up.
I mean, this is upsetting, and it mirrors fanaticism in our own world. I mean, this scene between Lyra and Mrs. Coulter is, to me, even though it's the only scene where almost nothing is really happening, it's just dialogue, is the most important scene in this whole episode. But to finish out this part of the summary, they do sort of try to make up, where she's basically like, would you like to go back to your dorm? Do you want to stay here? And Lyra agrees to stay with her. And then Mrs. Coulter immediately goes from mothering mode to manipulation mode. And she's like, oh, okay, so you're going to stay. So I learned from the master that you have the alethiometer. Could you hand that over? So Lyra says, okay. She gives her this box. And Mrs. Coulter pries it open, and inside is not the alethiometer, but is the spy fly.
I remember when she handed over the box, I was like, oh, Lyra's an old spiteful something. I loved it. I was hyped. She handed it over. I just went right back to the scene on the boat when she's about to toss it out and Ma Costa stops her. And I was all like, yes, I was watching it as it was happening, knowing that she's about to pry that thing open and get lit up.
Brilliant chess move by Lyra. I loved it. And then immediately her and Pan make a run for it. The golden monkey and Mrs. Coulter both freak out, which was actually kind of amazing.
And Lyra freaks out. Pan has to bring her back. They're like screaming through the door. And Pan is like, yo, enough already, Lyra. Let's go. We gotta get the fuck up out of here. What are you doing? Like,
It was a pretty amusing scene. Everybody is just having like a meltdown. So Lyra runs away right away. She pulls the fire alarm and she finds Roger and tells him that, you know, he has to go and find the children who have been severed from their demons and convince them to leave. She is not just interested in leaving with the children who still have demons. She wants everyone to come with her. And he says, he's a little bit apprehensive, but he says, well, what are you going to do? And she says, what I'm best at, causing chaos.
Yes, yeah, send Roger, once again, on the toughest, most difficult, dangerous mission. The guy you just found 2 seconds ago, and you're just going to go light some shit up. I'm just going to go cause chaos. Which she does. She did well.
This was great. And it's also, she's very, you know, she's self-reflective. She knows that this is her strength.
Yeah, she does.
She's very good at getting underfoot of adults and just causing mayhem. And she knows that's her strength, that Roger is the person to send to go convince these other kids, and that she's just going to create diversions everywhere so that everyone can escape. I think this was a good call by her.
I do too. I dug it. I love this sequence for so many different reasons. I first of all, the scene in the room with Mrs. Coulter and Lyra is so loaded and so powerful and moves the narrative from Mrs. Coulter's side along in a way that I didn't expect in this interaction. And it actually makes you think of all the things you've seen leading up to this point from her. And in that moment, like, it just makes you feel a little bit bad for her until she goes to manipulation mode, where you're feeling like, man, this woman has been totally indoctrinated. She's doing this also being manipulated and guided, because she knew that she could be punished when she went to the magisterium. She knew they were trying to take this project away from her. So she already knows how they get down. And so she's doing a lot of these things because of her position in the world also. And it just, I don't know. I felt a little bad for her.
Yeah, I mean, Mrs. Coulter is such a complex character in the show. She's cruel.
Yeah.
And you would want, as a villain, and this is our sixth episode, and even though Boreal has those villain vibes and we know he's up to no good, she is the main antagonist of the show. And so, as a villain, usually in fantasy and sci-fi, villains can tend to be pretty one-dimensional. They're just interested in power. But Mrs. Coulter is a character who is single-minded about her mission, but also has these cracks in her persona where we can really see the conflicts beneath. Like, she, this is a woman who does love Lyra. She's capable of love. I'm sure she loved Azrael as well. And I keep thinking back to that scene. I think it was in the second episode when Lyra told her she wasn't in control. When she is giving us glimpses of the person who has feelings, a person who is telling her daughter why she abandoned her, that's when she's not in control. But then she slips back into control so quickly. As soon as she makes up with Lyra, she remembers, all right, okay, so really what I want from her is the alethiometer. That's more important than, you know, actually keeping my promise to answer her questions and be somewhat transparent. Like, just give me the alethiometer. And she also tells Lyra that you have to choose a side. And Lyra does choose. And she chooses against her. She chooses to stay with the side of the children and the Egyptians and not to be with the Magisterium and Mrs. Coulter. So it was just such a look. There was so much happening. And it's really, I have to say that both Ruth and Daphne, who, you know, I'm on first name basis with both of them.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no question.
We're besties. They nailed the scene. I mean, both of them play it like a chess game. Mrs. Coulter advances a chess piece. Lyra responds. I mean, they were just, it was such a great back and forth between Ruth Wilson and Daphne Keene. I was so impressed with it. In the rest of the, it's a quiet moment compared to the rest of the episode, which is just like horror, like a, it was kind of like a half episode of a horror movie and half was like a all out like fantasy battle. But this right in between is the bridge was really effective and you know, gave us some more information that we didn't have before. I like the explanation of dust here. At least we understand what dust does, even if we don't understand exactly what dust is. Dust is what they attribute to being responsible for essentially free will, which is making life choices that the Magisterium would think are sinful.
Dust sounds like hormones. That's what it sounds like. It sounds like they're like contributing to hormones. Like, I know it's more than that, and I'm just making a joke. It's a little tongue-in-cheek, but it sounds like they're like right at puberty. You get this thing, and when it happens, you start having these crazy thoughts, i.e., I want a bone. It just sounds like what it is. Like, I don't know. That's how I picked up on it. When I was listening, it was like they were, she felt very convicted about what was happening with her and Azrael and her marriage. And it's all kind of translated into her mind about negative thoughts and negative this. Or maybe you have, like you said, free will and you want to do something else. But to me, it just feels like that's what the author is doing in this. To me, is like he's drawing this real connection between like the way people kind of shame people for natural feelings in the world, natural choices, mm-hmm. things that people would normally feel. And he's saying how like society and sometimes like very, you know, religious societies can try to muzzle that and tell people how unnatural it is. And if you buy into that, that's where the conflict is, mm-hmm. right? So that's what I got anyway from it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah, no, and the other thing that I found was really, really cool in this section was the scene when that we're gonna talk about. Like, she hears when she's being put into the scene for intercision, the machine for intercision, she like hears them say, like, if you leave the door open, that it could destroy the machine. Uh-huh. So that leads us into the next thing, right? Pan tells Lyra they have to get to the intercision lab and destroy the machine. She understood from that interaction how that's possible. So just as she's about to go do that, the creepy nurse arrives and tells her that she should get back with the other children. Lyra asked the nurse, in what was a very, very good decision, how she lost her demon and what her demon's name was. The nurse seems lost in thought about her demon, Nicholas, and Lyra runs past her. Roger finds the demonless children and convinces them to come with him. I know they separated you from your demons, but you still have a choice. Roger as you text me, has got some bass in his voice when he's doing this.
Yes, he's like, listen, let's go. I know things are not going well. I know you've been through a terrible ordeal, but you have a choice. You can stay here and, you know, let what they did to you sit, or you can come with me and seek a better life. And he uses their demons. And he says, like, if you don't come with me, your demons will only ever know the pain of being separated from you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, really powerful. Really, really powerful stuff from Roger. Good stuff from Roger. So Pan and Lyra decide to destroy the cutting machine by opening the doors and turning it on. They escape just as the room is completely destroyed by an explosion. Just then, Lee's hot air balloon appears above the station. Mrs. Coulter decides to escape through the venting system.
Looking just like the golden monkey when he crossed through it.
Just like it.
Just like him.
Should have had practice through her demon. Anyway, just as the children are making a run for the door, the Egyptians arrive and Ma Costa kills Dr. Randall. From this point on, it's all-out war between the Tartars and the Egyptian forces, including Lee, Yurik, and our girl, Serafina Pekala, shows up and is slicing and dicing up people. She ran through all of them real quick. I love this scene. This is my favorite scene.
Serafina is the Captain Marvel of this group. Like, she just unmatched. She just shows up and is like, I'm the most powerful one here. I got you.
It was a struggle. They were struggling. It looked like they may not win. John Fah was on his back getting wrecked. And she just was like, you know what? This is going a little too long. I'm just going to slice these dudes up. And all the Tartars drop. It was wild. I loved it. I love it. Just when they thought that it was going to go down the other way, Serafina to the rescue. Mrs. Coulter sees the battle has been lost just as the demonless child arrive and are united with the Egyptians. That was really great.
Yeah. I was so glad. I mean, seeing the children who've been separated from their demons following Roger, and then the Egyptians immediately just, they don't react to them in the same way that Lyra and Pan reacted to Billy when they first found him. They know that these are still children, even though it probably doesn't feel right. The Egyptians just immediately start embracing the kids. It was so moving. Just like to let them know. And at first I thought that there's like Egyptian man who goes to a child right away. And it seems like they know each other. And maybe that's true. But then Ma Costa just starts hugging the random kids.
Yeah. Yeah. She's great.
Yeah. Just to let them know we're here for you. We're on your side. You're still a person. It was, I got a little teary eyed when that happened because it just, these kids have been through such a horrible ordeal and just left alone in this room until Roger comes and says, come with me. And then the first people they find after they take this risk and come with Roger embrace them. They don't recoil from them as if there's something wrong with them. They welcome them. I loved it.
I did too. It was really great. And it just shows you the character of these people. They left where they were. They called people from all around the world to come with them, to travel north to something unknown, to then find out the atrocities, continue to keep coming, you know, hide Lyra under risk of, like, everything to them, and then get there and help with a lot of help from Serafina, free the children, and then embrace them and show them compassion and love and all those things. The Egyptians are just great.
Yeah, for sure. Compared to the other groups of people, you know, the Magisterium or the people in the previous town, Trollison, who just kind of turned a blind eye to what was happening, the Egyptians are just stand up. Like, they really followed through on their pledge to find these kids. You have to respect that.
100%. So, as the Egyptians embrace the children, as Mrs. Coulter watches, and she escapes and creeps away slowly and quietly. As Lyra prepares to leave, she speaks to Ma Costa and tells her that it was Billy who showed them they could escape. Lyra says that she's going with Lee and Yurik and Roger to free her father. While Roger and Lyra sleep in the balloon, now they're, you know, resting. They got away from Bowfinger, and Roger decided to come along with Lyra on this journey north. Serafina flies to the balloon to tell Lee that he must protect Lyra because she is destined to be important, to create and resolve conflict. The fate of more than this world remains on her. And Lee says that he needs some cash money. He needs some ducats. He's like, yo, I didn't sign up for this. I signed up to help the Egyptians. Lord Fa was paying me. Now you're talking about, like, this dangerous mission. I'm going to need some money.
Yeah, he was really like, so my contract with the Egyptians is over. And I just wanted to talk about my rate. You know, there was a lot of danger associated with this previous mission. So I just want to nail out the details of my contract. And Serafina is like, so...
So about that contract.
I can't pay you in money, but...
I can pay you in love. In love, not her love, but just in general, saying that love is what's going to feed you more than the money. And he has to admit that he loves Lyra and that he will protect her. Serafina tells him to follow the polar star to Adriel. The Egyptians head back south with their children and their demons. Lord Fa is concerned that some of the children will not be welcomed home once they return again. Ma Kassa says that those who cannot return to their parents will join the Egyptians. She tells Lord Fa that Billy would have been proud of them. I just want to take a shout out real quick and just say that in that moment when she says that and the two of them are kind of holding hands and walking off, it becomes clear to me, it's insinuated, I felt, that Billy was their kid. And I felt like even it goes back to when the Egyptians were singing that song and he was talking and he was singing Dear Son. Maybe he's not speaking about son in the figurative sense, in the broad sense. Maybe he was singing specifically about his son. And it made me even more emotional about that.
Yeah, on my first watch, I didn't feel strongly that came across in this episode. But then when you text me about it and I was rewatching it, this whole conversation alludes to, I feel like it's confirming this is their child, because the conversation actually starts by him saying, I thought we would be bringing him home with us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think we can go ahead and say Billy is Lord Fa and Ma Costa's child.
Yeah. I'm gonna, that's my headcanon, no matter what they say, like on this show, the show headcanon, because in the books it's completely different, but that's my show headcanon and I'm sticking with it. So that's what we'll say. We'll say that. And then, you know, of course, because we need this scene in a show, and we'll talk about that later, back in the air balloon, Lee hears sounds outside. The balloon is overtaken by a cliff gas. Lee and Yorick attempt to protect Lyra and Roger, but Lyra falls from the balloon, and then yet another episode ends with Lyra in peril. Why?
I don't... Yeah, I was just like,
Can we find another way to move the story forward, please? Come on, guys.
Yeah, this ending was so unnecessary. I don't know. The editing of the last two episodes, even though but let me just say, since we're at the end, I loved this episode.
Yeah.
I thought it was great. It was my favorite of the season so far. I loved it because of those quiet dialogue moments and the clues and hints that we received from the dialogue, which had been not missing, but haven't been as explicit and clear. I also loved that the demon connection is becoming more clear to the audience, and the importance of it is being emphasized. I did not love the editing. I mean, we talked a little bit about this scene with Will that seemed completely out of place. I don't understand why it was in there. And then the end, I felt like the episode should have ended with Lord Fa and Ma Costa's conversation, but that they had this, like, two-minute scene with the cliff gas, and they didn't want to put that at the beginning of the next episode. And I just... I don't like cliffhangers like this because, one, we know Lyra's not going to die. So don't give me a cliffhanger. I mean, this is literally a cliffhanger problem. Don't give me her falling out of the balloon if you're not going to resolve it pretty quickly and I have to wait a week to see where she falls, I know she's not going to die. So, like, don't bother with the... It just didn't feel right. And I was like, of course, Lyra has this great episode that where she's doing all the things we've wanted to see from her all season. She's using her insubordination and her ability to create chaos for the good guys. And then she has... Then we're supposed to be concerned about her life again. And, you know, I just... We've ended 3 or 4 episodes this season with Lyra in peril.
Yeah, I agree. It's heavy-handed, and I think, I mean, that takes us into, you know, what we like, what we question, what we want to see more of. And I guess I know you have some stuff you wanted to get to. I'll stay with this point just real quick to kick it off and just say I really question once again some of the changes that they made from the source material. I really do, because and I understand it's budgetary. Like, for some of it has to be budgetary. For example, and this is a little meta, when Serafina comes and wrecks all those people, that's great from a cinematic standpoint. And, of course, I think it's great because it shows how much of a badass she is. But in the books, it's like a whole group of witches. And they're losing the battle. Like, they're legitimately losing the battle. And the witches come and save them. And that is how Lee gets roped into taking her north. Not because he wants to, but because the only way they're going to escape this battle is to get Yurik and Roger and her into the balloon and start heading out of there to get away from Bolvanger, because they're going to lose if not. And then the witches pull them along in the balloon. That, to me, makes sense why him and Serafina would have the conversation and why he would agree to continue, because he's like, okay, I didn't plan on going, but I'm going to go. In this scene, Lyra just basically says, oh yeah, I didn't just come north for the children. I came north for my dad. And then hops on the balloon with Roger, and Roger just goes with her because he didn't want to go with the other children back home, right? He just wanted to go with Lyra north to look out some dude he barely even knows with a guy he just met 2 seconds ago, and just keeps going. It doesn't even make story sense. It does to me. This is a big flaw in this. I questioned that a bunch in this episode.
Yeah, I mean, my question was also about storytelling, and this is, I like hesitated a little bit about whether or not I wanted to bring this up, because this was something that people started complaining about with Game of Thrones, and people started complaining about with Westworld, which was the how. But when you... All right, so I'll just say what my issue was. So the Egyptians, that short scene with the Egyptians trying to get to Bolvanger, they're experiencing all kinds of hardship. Like, mm-hmm. It's maybe 30 seconds, but they're struggling. And yep. They have Yurik and they have Lee, and there's a whole, like, they're struggling. And I get it, they're with a large group of people, but you do see how difficult the terrain is. This is, yeah. They're like scaling like mountains. Like, this is not an easy place to get to. Okay, so then how did Billy end up a half-day ride from them? Like, I don't understand how I'm supposed to believe this kid made it down. Like, I just did. And so I'm sure there's a way to explain this. And it wouldn't take a lot of storytelling to do it. But when you have hows like this, and this is only one, but when you have the audience asking a how, how did this happen? You sort of break the contract of we're suspending disbelief. Because
100%.
Now, like, it's a very sensitive thing that people are like, okay, there's talking animals in this. But then when things are presented is difficult, but then in another circumstance are easy, it's hard for me to... I just, the whole time... In this episode, every time they alluded to the fact that Billy had escaped, I was like, but first of all, how can he even get out? Lyra can't get out.
Yeah, and this is the thing. The author already solved that problem in the book. Like, he doesn't escape. They're dropping kids off in that little small town that they look like they're close to death. Like, if they would have just let that be what it was, like, they were like, okay, this person's not going to make it. So he's one of the earlier ones. They were dropping bunches of kids off into that little small town.
Exactly. Which is why last week I was like, these people are monsters for leaving this kid alone. But mm-hmm. apparently he escaped and made it somehow. It just, that part didn't make any sense to me. And I think when you have a fantasy television show or a fantasy book, frankly, if you cannot connect the pieces, people start looking, the cracks in your world building start to show.
Agreed.
And so, like, we're pretty forgiving about certain rules that haven't been explained. We can always assume dust will be explained to us eventually. The relationship between the demons, why that relationship exists. All of those things were like, oh, yeah, we'll get to those. But in the meantime, we'll just go along with this ride. But then you show these Egyptians going through this, like, really awful trip. And then, but I'm supposed to believe that Billy, who was near death, made this trip on his own. Like, I didn't, that's what I questioned from this episode. I can't get beyond it it just really bugged me. I don't know why.
It bugs me too, because what it feels like is the same thing as what we're calling out with Lyra always being a pearl at the end of the episode. It feels like we need to move the story along and we're just going to do it. Like, there's no real reason why Roger and Lyra get in that balloon with Lee and that Lee automatically starts pulling away and taking them, because when they met up with Lee, he didn't even agree to go beyond Bolvanger. He just said, I'm coming to get them. The same way that it doesn't make sense that Billy ends up in that town by escaping, and that he's the only one of all the Sever children to have enough agency to be like, I'm getting out of here. And the rest of those kids wouldn't even move, and they would just sit there counting. So it doesn't make a lot of sense and how they're set up other aspects. They didn't really choose and commit to one way of telling the story in that those times. And that's why I think it's frustrating.
Yeah, I just didn't like it. So should we talk about what we liked?
Yeah, talk about what you liked. What did you like on this one?
I really like that we're finally learning more about the relationship of demons, about why dust is so important in this story. They clearly believe that dust is connected to sinning. I sort of read it as free will, but I like they, you know, the way it was phrased. I, for the first time, I kind of felt like the show was skirting away from the religious commentary. Not necessarily that they were ignoring it entirely, because obviously, you know, they're still using the magisterium's religious titles, cardinal, father, those sorts of things. But I didn't feel like they were addressing head on that this is a story about religious tyranny, essentially. And I liked that in this episode, we saw some of the fanaticism. I mean, I just thought that the both Dr. Cooper and Mrs. Coulter's explanations of what they're doing and trying to justify it to two characters who are, Lyra's not buying Mrs. Coulter's version, but Dr. Rendell is really looking to be convinced, and they're trying to convince these two people who are not convinced. They're skeptical about this. And I thought that those speeches were really, really well done, and this fanaticism came through.
Yeah, I like that. I also will say that I really liked the reunion between Roger and Lyra, as I spoke about earlier. And I really, really liked some of the scenes with the kids and how they were interacting and that we've spoken about throughout this episode. What I found in this is that, kind of like speaking of what transition from what we, you know, questioned to what we liked, is that what they've found a way to do in the show is they've taken a way to make the big moments in the show smaller and the small moments bigger, amplify them. And I think that that's what I liked, was that the small moments felt amplified.
Yeah, for sure.
The conversations that were little moments that you wouldn't think would be as big, they really felt like, you know, the conversation with Mrs. Coulter, the conversation with the demons between Roger and between Cecilia and Pan, Roger and Lyra's demons, the moments with Annie and Lyra that are really powerful and move it along. All those things feel really strong, and I really like that about this episode.
Yeah, I would say that what you're seeing is the difference between Pullman's writing and Thorne's writing. Mm-hmm. Pullman was, and this is just my opinion, I think lots of people would probably disagree, but at least in The Golden Compass, Pullman was very much plot driven and theme driven. Whereas Thorne is less dedicated to the plot points and more dedicated to the character building. And so those little moments are so important, because what the show has kind of trained us to do is look for the character moments, because we've seen so many great small moments between characters that are really important to the story. Like if we even just look back to that conversation that Ma Costa and Lyra had when they were going north about throwing the spy fly into the ocean, that conversation was consequential. The information, the way that Ma Costa put that is what kept Lyra from tossing it, and it turned out to be super important, you know, later.
Yeah,
she uses it to escape. So I think that's just a difference in emphasizing different parts of the story. And everyone, when they read a story, takes different things away from it. So my guess is that when Thorne read the source material, and the way he read it was he was looking for those things in the characters. Whereas when I read it, I was like digging into the plot. Like Mrs. Coulter just seemed like a villain to me. Like I didn't really care about her motivations. I just knew that she was like single-minded about her mission, and I couldn't care less about her before the story. Like I wasn't interested in knowing more about her. And now I find myself every time she's on screen wondering, aside from what we know what happened with Azrael, wondering what made her this way. Like she makes a comment to Lyra when she's giving her the drink that has the chamomile in it about that she was an emotional child. And I just wondered, is this a woman who, even as a child, they were trying to suppress her emotions? Is this why she is the way she is? I never found myself having those questions about her or Azrael or Boreal.
Yeah.
In when I was reading the books, like I just kind of read what was on the page and didn't really think much more about it. I was much more interested in Lyra and Will and Roger than I was in any of the adult characters. But I really like what they've done on the show to elevate the character work. And so those tiny moments do become kind of outsized, and the battles become, and they're important. And it was, listen, I love the battle scene. Give me a battle.
This battle scene? Yeah. I love the battle scene too.
Give me a battle. But I don't want to watch an hour of it. I just want it. I thought what Serafina did, that was a cool scene to see, but I didn't want to watch like a whole hour of mayhem going down at the station.
I do appreciate that Ma Costa kept to her promise. She was like, no, we're not going to do that. We need to kill. Oh, she held it down. She's
Yeah.
You remember my son, Billy? You remember him? Yeah, guess what?
I bad for Dr. Randall. Like,
he caught a bad one.
He got clipped real quick.
Real quick. And then the other doctor came out acting all crazy, and Lee was like, oh, no, that's not going down. Take you out, too. Like, they held it down. I'm not going to lie. They did come for the battle. It's surprising that they did so well. And even when, like I said, when they're about to lose... Here came Serafina. I mean, that leads us, what I'd like to see more of is more of what they did with the backstories and the kind of like the things that you're talking about, like understanding more why dust is important, understanding more why the demons are important. Continue to deepen these things. But more than anything, this is going to sound crazy if you've been listening to our show for the last five episodes. I kind of want to see Azrael. It's been like 5-6 episodes. Like, let's see Azrael. Like, 6 episodes. Let's see this guy. What's going on?
I'm going to one-up you. I need to see Boreal again. I miss my boy. Like, come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want to see his minions. I want to see Boreal. Like,
fair enough.
In fairness, Azrael's been gone for a real long time. Boreal's literally only been gone for an hour. And I'm like, but what's he up to? What's he doing? What's good? I just don't
know. He's just crossing between worlds looking for Grumman. You know, that's what it is. You know, he's identifying his skulls and remains. Yeah, I want to see Boreal too. And the reason I was, you know, I think it's fascinating that we're even saying we want to see Boreal more because, like you said, in the source material, Boreal is in a cocktail party for like a hot second. He's not even like that important in the grand scheme of things in the first book. And they have done wonders in fleshing out how much you care about him early on in the series. It's really, really cool. And yeah. He's done a great job playing him.
Yeah, I think they've really done a great job of his character. And they had to do that if they were going to introduce Will, which they did. I'm looking forward to seeing Yurik and Yofur. I think that's going to be a interesting reunion, to say the least. And I want to see how they play it and like the tension in their, them seeing each other again. I need like some really important scene having to do with Will. If we're going to have to travel back to our world every episode, which it seems like we haven't really missed an episode where there's never been an episode where that didn't happen, I don't think. So then I need those scenes to be of consequence. And I'm looking forward to seeing Will progress in his research about his dad. And is there going to be some kind of confrontation between Boreal's minions and Will and his mom? That's what I'm looking forward to.
I'm with you on that. And I mean, if we can get that in the next episode, I think we're going to get a lot like in the next episode. I think that, that they move this story along pretty quickly. And I think, you know, we have two episodes left to go. So I can only imagine that it's going to be more of the same with like what we get. And yeah, I'm excited about the Bear Bowl. I'm excited about it. Let's go. We're going to dub this Bear Bowl, just like Clegane Bowl. We're going to dub it that. Like, I think it's going to happen. I think at some point we'll see it go down.
So. Before we wrap up our episode, I just wanted to talk a little bit about one of the reasons I love this episode so much, which is more just about why my personal love for fantasy and why I think we're so drawn to it is a culture. Lyra and Roger do so much in this episode, and they're kids. They're like, Lyra's maybe 12, and Roger, what would you say, he's maybe a year or two younger than her?
A year or two younger.
Yeah, they're children, and they essentially cause an uprising.
Yeah.
Of other children. And then like also Annie, right? Like, she is a pretty minor character. I'm sure we will never see her again, but she is organizing other kids to resist in small ways.
Agreed.
This is a constant fantasy or sci-fi trope. A lot of people like fantasy and sci-fi because they appreciate escaping our world. One of the reasons I like it, and one of the reasons I particularly like it in children's literature most of all, is because it's really the only art form where, or I should say art genre, it's not an art form, because the genre can take many forms, but it's really the only genre where one person can make a huge difference despite the odds. And I think we see that in action with Lyra and Roger organizing this escape. And I really loved seeing how much Roger has matured in the few episodes that we haven't seen him. Like, this was a kid who was part of a group of kids that were very compliant the last time we saw them, which I think was episode 2. And now he is, one, fully willing to follow Lyra's lead, but also willing to do something that's kind of scary to him. Like, if we think back to when Lyra approached Billy, Pan was freaking out. And Lyra was scared. They were all scared by just, like, Billy's energy. It didn't feel right. Imagine walking into a room full of energy like that. Imagine little Roger, who you know, seemed, I mean, I thought he was pretty brave in talking back to Lord Asriel in the first episode, but that's a different type of bravery. This is like really chilling stuff, like walking into a room of kids you knew who have changed in a way you don't understand that makes you physically uncomfortable and emotionally uncomfortable. And he does it. And I just really loved that this show to me was like, I don't have any kids, full disclosure. And if I had kids, I'm not sure that I would feel super great about them watching this particular episode. But the bravery, the way that these kids rise to the occasion is admirable. And it's one of my favorite things about fantasy and sci-fi. Whenever you have a protagonist who has a prophecy attached to them or is fighting against an oppressive force, it's really about one person and their willingness to sacrifice, take risk, cause chaos, you know, mm-hmm. do all the things that Lyra and Roger are willing to do in this episode. And I just loved it. I thought that this was a really great demonstration of resistance and standing up against something that's wrong. And that's why I really liked when Roger said, yeah, they've taken your demons and they could probably mm-hmm. do worse, but you still have a choice. Mm-hmm. So I just love that. I just couldn't, like, I didn't want to end our episode without noting that, because it's one of my favorite things about the genre.
Yeah, no, it's a great call out, and we share in that. Like, I definitely feel it's a place where that is not only championed and kind of shown and highlighted throughout stories, but I just think, like, you know, I actually recently had dinner with a friend who was talking about kids and her kid, and I love when kids are connected as long as they possibly can. And us in adulthood, right? We're sitting here talking about a fantasy story. As long as we possibly can, stay connected to that idea of magic and wonder and being able to stand up for the least among us and kind of just those tropes that we see in fantasy and sci-fi stories is like, you know, and sometimes, you know, it's somebody who's as great as, you know, a big character that we love, you know, and sometimes it's most times in fantasy, it's always going to be like the person you least expect, the kid, the person who is not really chosen, but they end up following on a certain journey and then coming across their strength and their power. And yeah, you're right. It's why I think we're all drawn to these stories and why I think we love these stories is because it shows us that we all can do this. We all can, you know, be that person that, as you said, stirs up a little chaos and makes like and resist against things that we know are tyrannical and really, like, you know, be better to each other. And it gives us those opportunities in these stories to travel it with somebody else who's being brave like that.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a demonstration of even when you don't think you have any power, you do.
Yeah.
So yeah. I love that part of this episode. I've always had a thing for Roger. He's an adorable kid, and I'm loving seeing him grow. So
he's back. He's back. Roger is back. He is here. So it's cool. And so we travel north to follow, you know, to find that guy Asriel.
I think you may have turned me off of Asriel entirely, because now I'm like, we're really, Lee and Yurik are gonna risk their lives to go free Asriel? Whatevs.
Exactly. Hey, Azzy, everyone's special. How about you take your special ass and figure out how to get out of your own cage? Okay, like, how about that? But we appreciate you again. We are on all the podcasting services you're listening to, right? Wherever one that you're at, please go and leave a review. We really appreciate it. 5 stars only, please. Please, please, please. And then hit us up at kinfolklore@gmail.com. And recently, we have just launched a Facebook group. So if you're there, you can do that. And you can also find us on Twitter at Kin Folklore Podcast. right? Is it Kinfolk Lore Pod or Kinfolk Lore Podcast?
Kinfolk Lore Pod.
All right, so Kinfolk Lore Pod, and interact with us there. We want to start getting some of your questions and ideas and feedback, and pretty soon we'll be talking about what we're going to do after His Dark Materials is over.
All right, thanks everyone. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.